This is Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping. With your hosts, William Whitebread and Mark Audio Slave Stewart.
Hey, welcome back, motherfuckers, to another episode of Rock Isn't Dead. You've got me, the Willy Whitebread, the usual extra gray foxed Mark the Audio Slave, and we have a special guest. Based on this week's episode, which is the blues, we called in an expert, Delta Drew Pearson.
What up?
Say hello. Say hello to your many fans, hello. Delta Drew. So that's Delta Drew. So, obviously, we picked the blues for this subject. Or for this week's subject, because it is the backbone of all rock and roll, yes?
Absolutely.
It is the backbone of all rap music, yes? Hip-hop?
Absolutely.
R&B?
Absolutely.
It's the backbone of everything. 12-bar blues. That's what started it all.
Did.
So, where did it originate?
I'd say New Orleans, actually.
New Orleans?
Absolutely.
1870s?
With the W.C. Handy.
That's it. W.C. And who was W.C. Handy?
He is a jazz musician.
Yep.
Predominantly played, I think, the trumpet.
Yep.
And basically started from there, and he started the 12-bar blues.
Yep. He was a very, very popular composer.
Absolutely.
Yep. But it originated in the southern plantations during the slave era. That's where we're talking about the original blues origination.
Well, that's where I'm talking about where blues derived from. What music they were listening to. Like, you know how
they were just singing stuff in the fields and stuff.
Right, but it all derived. They heard music. They've heard music before. They didn't hear like a music coming from a house and go.
Maybe like swing music.
Well, that's what I mean.
That's probably what was going on back then.
Well, swing and ragtime. That.
Yeah. They were doing the Charleston.
But back then, post W.C. Handy, this composer that kind of cultivated the 12-bar blues progression, the predominant sound back then was, I would say, gospel, bluegrass, and country music.
Well, yeah. You can't forget about classical music as well.
And classical music, obviously. Yeah.
To that as well.
Right. And that was still very predominant because we're talking the 1870s here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the early 1900s.
They're listening out of the sousaphones.
Yeah, the phonograph.
Victrolas.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I like that shit.
I do too.
That's what we're talking about. We're talking about like early 1900s elevator music and shit. So, but you made a good point there. The actual smoothing of the blues sound was made from plantations and from African American workers.
Called work songs.
Work songs.
African chanting.
Right.
Field holla.
Field holla.
Spiritualisms. Yeah. African spiritualism.
Yep. And it was funny too, because on a couple of documentaries that I watched about the blues, they would also use it as a means of communication, like down the field and things like that. Like they would say, "Oh, the boss is coming," things like that, and it would go all the way down the field, and that was like a means of communication.
Where did you get all that?
Documentary.
Documentary told you that.
Yes, documentary. Oh, okay. I trust all the documentaries that I watch.
Facebook documentary.
No.
Me too.
Yeah, I don't put any faith into Facebook documentaries.
Right?
None of their fucking bull. But anyway, so it was like, I don't know, for me, whenever I'm out there, you know, doing yard work or something like that, I have to be listening to music. Or I'm out doing like a monotonous task that I don't necessarily like to do.
So I'm not going to say, you're out there singing the
No, I'm not out there singing Swing Low and shit. But like I'm out there listening to music. But you need something to fill your time. And they didn't have much.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything. Obviously, they didn't have CD players.
Obviously, they were getting screwed.
Right. They didn't have anything. So they cultivated their own way of communication, their only way of passing the time.
Yeah.
And the thing that I've always really appreciated about the blues, in contradiction to other music, is the blues tells a story about the person. You can learn a lot about the person.
Right.
About the lyrics they're saying. You know, absolutely. It's not fuck bitches, get money, or a 16-minute guitar solo from Jimi Hendrix. They're telling you a story.
There's actually a song out there called Matchbox Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And Matchbox Blues is basically letting you know that they're packing all their stuff in the backpack that they got, whatever they have, satchel, I don't know. But they're packing whatever they have and they're leaving. That's the Matchbox Blues because it's small. Yeah. It's all they got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what's up.
Yep. And that's what they would talk about. You know, like Marnie Smith, she would talk about these things, like these different like whorehouses that they had back then, because that was back in the really shitty juke joints. And I forget what the actual name that they used to call these whorehouses back then, because this was in the dark time of America. This was in the weird post-Civil War kind of odd time that we had in America, kind of the dark ages, as I would like to call it, is bad time. And so they didn't have anything, so they had to find a way and a place to play their music and cultivate their music, which the juke joints.
Yep.
You know, because we were very, the country was segregated at that time, and you couldn't, you know, an African American couldn't just walk into a bar.
Hard telling what went on in those places.
Very hard to
say.
Do
you know where the term blues came from?
I do not. Well, I know what it means, but not where it came from. There's different theories on where it came
from, but one of the main theories I found was it came from, was called the Blue Devils. The Blue Devils, meaning melancholy and sadness.
Yeah.
That was George Coleman was the first one to use that in his act called Blue Devils in 1798.
Yeah.
And then the phrase also derived from Britain in the 1600s. It was a term referred to intense, severe alcohol withdrawal symptoms. The blues, you know.
Yeah, because back then, that's what they used for everything was alcohol.
Right. So if you were withdrawing from alcohol, you're like, oh man, he's got the blues. You know?
I always talk about like how rad would it have been to be a doctor back then? It would have been so fucking cool because they used to prescribe shit like coke and morphine just on the fly and stuff. They're like, wow, it seems you have ghosts in your blood. Let's do coke about it.
Remedy.
Yeah. Let's do morphine about that for a while and see how that works. And then you get a case of the blues when you can't get out of bed in the morning.
Now all of a sudden you feel better, you know? That's what the blues are all about.
Right. And so like we said, and we talked a little bit about Robert Johnson and a little bit how he came to, you know, fruition, but that's a little bit later. Well, not much later.
Not really. Yeah.
But they, just the sheer like necessity is the mother of invention aspect to the blues. Cause these guys and gals were picking guitars made by, you know, punching nails into the side of their houses and wiring up strict, you know, chicken wire and running a bottle
making
across
it. Anything they can get their hands on.
A mouth harp, a harmonica. They were doing anything they could.
Yeah, washed up bass.
She still had the voice like Count Basie, you know? Count Basie was still jazz, but still going in the blues, you know?
Yeah. Right. Telling a story. I saw in another thing how they made their flutes back then. They would take a long, like, metal rod and heat it up in a fire and take a piece of bamboo and run it in there until it was hollow and then put it back in the fire and make their flute holes.
Fucking badass.
Isn't that cool as shit? Like, you know,
that's how I would make a flute.
Yeah. The tune in Gangs in New York. That was from an old Delta, like a new Louisiana blues band that actually wrote that song.
1860 something?
Yeah,
like that?
1860 or something like that. Fucking cool as shit. Absolutely. And it all sounds great.
Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Was that another one?
Well, that was kind of hinted on the story of Robert Johnson, and that if you guys picked, I mean, I'm sure you guys.
And you're
picked
still talking about running the strings off the side of the house, a cigar box, and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, they just did whatever.
They had to.
Yeah, had to. They had nothing.
Couldn't afford anything like that.
Couldn't afford anything.
Even if
you
had a chance to, somebody would probably take it away from them.
Exactly, and I did do a little bit of digging into that, and they literally had no money.
No.
These musicians, they had nothing.
Absolutely.
Absolutely nothing.
That's what the blues are for.
That's what the blues are for. And that's
what
it
feel better.
Yeah, it tells a story. It tells a story about how you're down, mm-hmm. how you're working, how you can't get ahead. And that's the whole emotional response to the music. And I think that cultivates and progresses the power of blues in and of itself.
That's why I love it so much, because it makes me feel like I'm not alone.
Right.
That's the beauty of it.
That's the beauty
Somebody
of it.
Somebody else feels the pain that I understand.
Right, exactly. And that's what music's for. And it's very difficult to find music nowadays that has an emotional touch to it. You know, because it's all just mindless bullshit. You know what I mean? It's mindless shit. Look at even our favorite guys, like Tool, their new album. Come on, dude.
Fantastic album.
Get out of town.
Love it. That's ridiculous.
What did you love about it? The same guitar riffs you've been hearing for 30 years?
And a song called Invincible. It's about...
that is a good song. That's the only good song I liked. Song.
That is a good song.
That's the only one I like, though, in the whole album.
But they did have a lot of repetitive guitar riffs. Like, they had one from The Pot.
That I don't disagree with.
I was like, what? Oh, what? No. And no vocal breakdowns. No Maynard vocal breakdowns.
Absolutely.
And no singles.
Nope.
I was like, this is weird. And maybe it's just, like, a little bit of being afraid of what I don't understand. I'm like, you know, maybe I just, this is hitting to a different market that I don't get.
But maybe that's how you learn a little more every time.
And everybody's different, I guess, because
yeah.
we thought Korn was a kick-ass album. He didn't like it.
You didn't like their new album, The Nothing?
Nope.
Wow.
I know.
That's wild. What about Slipknot's new record? Did you like them?
What?
Oh, that was like their magnus opus, man. That was a great album. To each their own, but that's the beauty of music.
Absolutely.
It speaks to different people in different languages.
You gotta love it.
But anyway, back to the blues.
Yep.
Delta Drew, let's talk a little bit about the early. What was your favorite portion of the early cultivation of the blues?
Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Just the simplicity of it. John Lee Hooker, even listen to John Lee Hooker's first few albums, just the tap, you know?
Yeah.
And then he just starts stringing it, and that's the beauty of it. You can hear the old school tempo, the style about it. It's
because
beautiful.
A lot of them didn't have any backup bands or anything. It was just them and a guitar.
They weren't allowed to have them.
Nope.
Oh,
they weren't allowed to have backup bands, and nobody would record them. Nobody would give them anything.
Well, yeah. Until when?
And probably the 40s, 50s, yeah. when it started picking up tempo with like the Chicago blues scene and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, when Muddy Waters and like Howlin' Wolf and stuff used to go over to Chicago to record and shit. That's when blues, and that was like pre-50s, before the pre-British blues takeoff. And that's when it really got put on the map. But another thing that fascinates me about the blues, because obviously it started rising to notice. It started getting noticed in the 20s, you know, the early 20s, you know.
That it did.
And the sheer mystery behind it, because there's so little other than word of mouth and documentaries and, you know, what you can read here and there, but there's, because they weren't getting recorded.
Yeah, because the first blues sheet music was I Got the Blues, published in 1908.
Yep.
But then the recording was the Dallas Blues in 1912.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Antonio Maggio who did the, yeah.
That's right.
Yep. And so, but
and then W.C. Handy the same year with the Memphis Blues.
Yep, that was, yep. That's where it came from. And see, but when the Delta Blues stuff was coming along, the Deep South Blues movement, there wasn't any recognition for it. Because, you know, obviously there wasn't Facebook or anything like there wasn't. And these folks weren't getting any recognition.
Nope. Yeah.
And it was considered the devil's music because gospel was still very predominant during that time. So it was looked down upon. It was looked down on, and they had to do it in secrets, which is where the juke joints came in.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They weren't going to walk into a glass recording studio and be able to record their shit. They'd get the hell out of here. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So there's so little.
That's when they had people like Elvis Presley sing their songs for them to get it out there.
Yeah, and then they're like, wow, this shit's great. Dude, we've been doing this for fucking 40 years.
Literally, I love it.
Well, B.B. King credits Frank Sinatra for getting a lot of blues artists, you know, their start.
Yeah,
so, including BB.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Love his cousin Albert King, man.
Yeah, yeah.
That dude can play.
Just the sheer mystery, man. And I think that's what Robert Johnson, like, he was good. You know, he was a good songwriter and he was a great guitar player for the time.
And he was possessed by the devil.
Yeah, he was possessed by the devil. There's just so much mystery because these folks, especially these big 1920s blues musicians, they would find out that they wanted to be a rambling music man, and they would just leave and pop up a year later in, you know, 15 states away, and you never knew they left.
That would mean John Lee Hooker right there.
Right. And I remember reading and looking at some things about Johnny Shines, because Johnny Shines is another one of my favorite blues musicians. He used to run around with Robert Johnson a lot. And
Son House
is the
Big
first
Bill Brunzy. Let's
Big
go.
Bill Brunzy, yeah. Absolutely. Son House was also an incredibly influential blues musician.
Absolutely.
Incredibly so. But yeah, that's what adds to this allure, because Robert Johnson, he got big and didn't even know it. He was rambling around the country and died before he even knew. You know, he came out with one record.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you're forgetting about Lightnin' Hopkins.
Lightnin' Hopkins.
Guy that was harping and playing the guitar as well.
Yeah.
He was... He was before his time as well.
Right.
Lightnin' Hopkins. Amazing.
Absolutely.
Amazing blues musician.
So it's just to me, the wonder of the blues. Obviously, it's the emotional aspect, but it's also, like I said, the sheer mystery behind it and the eeriness to it. Like, if you listen to Robert Johnson sing, it'll take you somewhere weird in your head if you really listen.
That's the goosebumps, you know what I'm saying? That's what
it.
Music takes you to. It takes
that
you to
yodel.
State of mind.
That high-pitched blues yodel, almost, you know? Which was, you know, that was very indicative of that time, too, I think. Would you agree with that yodel that they used to do?
Absolutely. I wouldn't say too much as a yodel, but they let the guitar speak for them as long.
Right.
And they'd be getting down with it. Like I said, John Lee Hooker is, you know, the boom, boom, like, that song. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So I definitely can get down with you with the yodel a little bit.
I wouldn't. Yeah, like you said, I don't know if I'd call it a yodel, but they had that like vibrato to their voice.
Now we're talking.
You know what I mean? What
that about. Sounds better than a yodel. Yodel sounds like somebody's out in Switzerland.
But to me, it kind of sounds like a yodel. And Howlin' Wolf used to talk about that a lot because he couldn't. He's like he said in an interview, he's like, I couldn't do no yodeling, so I just yell. And it done me just fine.
But that's how he was talking. Exactly. You're doing it just perfectly.
Yeah, he'll scare you into liking his ass, bro.
he was a big guy.
Yeah, he'll scare you into liking his music.
6'7", 6'8".
Yeah.
He was like 300 pounds. He was a big guy.
Monster. Fucking monster human being. So what else was going around in that time? Because there was more blues than just the Delta blues.
Well, that's when everything moved up. If we're talking about Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, that's when everybody moved from the Delta going up to the Chicago.
Chicago.
And then that's when it started making a name for itself, like with Willie Dixon.
Yeah.
Muddy Guy was already starting to get in the mix after...
Muddy Waters.
Oh, Muddy Waters.
Chicago.
Well, he was...
That's what's fucking up right there. That dude is the fucking man.
Yeah, he is the man. So yep. much so that I think he's probably the most covered blues musician of all time.
Well, that's how you got Rolling Stones.
That's how they got their name.
That's how you got their name.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
That from that man. Well, I would have to say Willie Dixon was more prominent.
Well, he wrote most of Muddy Waters' music.
He was the guy behind the scenes, and nobody even knows that.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, he wrote a lot of their stuff. And even like we were talking about like them people covering his stuff. A lot of people, like Led Zeppelin, covered a lot of his stuff.
Yep, like Let the Juice Run Down the Leg, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Whole Lot of Love. That was a fucking Muddy Waters song,
absolutely.
You know? Predominantly and almost completely. But another subgenre that I never even... Because, I you know, you listen to a song and you're like, yeah, that's pretty bluesy. You know, but I guess there's a lot of different subgenres like anything else. The vaudeville. Blues section, the female blues movement. Is that how you say it? Vaudeville?
Yes, it is exactly how you say it. I'd have to say Billy. What? I'm forgetting her name right now all of a sudden. But
I don't know of a Billy, but I know of a
Billie
Ma
Holiday.
Rainey.
Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
She was still blue, or still jazz, but still was going into the bluesy with the way that she was singing vibrato, I guess.
That vibrato. You know? Yeah,
but it was just the way that she was doing it. Count Bessie, absolutely.
Yeah, Gertrude Ma Rainey.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
she had the voice. She
Aunt
Ma Rainey was.
Yeah.
She was big. She was a big woman too, man. She made her presence well known.
Yeah, Marnie Smith.
Marnie Smith, absolutely.
That's another good one.
Absolutely,
and I love seeing that aspect of thing because especially for that time, for an African American woman in the 20s. To be gaining a significant amount of recognition and getting records printed, that's huge.
That's the fucking cool part about it is that these guys were taking these women with them because they knew they were just as talented as they were.
If not more so.
Not more so, absolutely.
I love it.
That's
amazing. It's pretty nice.
It's pretty nice.
Nice gig they had. Had old Harriet Tubman take him in the Underground Railroad to the record label house.
The record label house.
The juke joint.
The Sun House record label juke joint.
The jukebox joint.
Yeah.
Chess Records. That's what's up. That's what started in Chicago. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Chess Records.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's just all so crazy. Like with Sun House, too, more specifically.
Wasn't that Tennessee, Sun Records?
I think so. I think they made one in Tennessee. But he was Mississippi when he met Robert Johnson. Because you know that story, I'm sure. Robert Johnson walks into a juke joint as a young man, and Son House is in there playing.
That's his idol.
Yep, and that's his idol. And Robert goes, hey, let me play a couple licks on that guitar. He plays it, and they laugh him out of the place.
Absolutely. He might have been nervous, though.
Oh, yeah.
He might have.
It's his fucking idol.
He was also like 16.
Well,
you know,
when he sold his soul to the devil.
Yeah, he left. Right? Yeah, he
supposedly
left and went to the crossroads.
You know?
And
would you do that?
Wouldn't die 5 years later? No. You didn't even make any money hardly.
You can't look up on Facebook going, oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to die 5 fucking years later. Would you fucking do that?
Yeah, you didn't answer that fucking chain mail. Now your ass is done, son.
I'll cross that road when I get there.
Your ass is fucking
done. Live most of your
You've lived most of your life already, Mark.
Every time I think about the crossroads, you ever think Supernatural with Dean?
Yeah, dude, I love that fucking show, man. That's what's up.
And that was a juke joint, wasn't it?
It was.
Kind of. It was like
a they brought
know.
It. They, I love
but,
that
but
show.
But it was
they
a Demon Hunter
juke joint.
They
bring up all that shit, though. That's what's cool about that show is they bring up all that music in that.
Yeah, they do.
It's cool.
I just think about
Shout out to Supernatural. I like it.
Supernatural.
I just think about the seafood joint in my hometown, Dixie Crossroads. Yeah. I do two fingers to Robert Johnson.
Well, also, I think about, what was that movie with, what was that movie about the blues with freaking Karate Kid?
Karate Kid. The Stevie Ray Vaughan documentary?
Crossroads. No. I think it was called Crossroads with Ralph Macchio.
Ralph Macchio.
I don't know if I've seen that.
Oh, you need to watch. It's a good movie.
Oh, I thought you were talking about.
It's literally Ralph Macchio pretending to be Robert Johnson.
What?
Yeah.
Ralph Macchio?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely.
Younger, you know, like right after Karate Kid.
Like, does he know who Robert Johnson is and he's just trying to emulate
him? He's trying to become a blues man down in the deep south. And he comes to the called Crossroads.
I'm just expecting him to, like, do some kung fu shit.
Yeah. He just comes out and does a fucking backflip. He the waxa on.
Crossroads, man.
Yeah. Waxa on the waxa off. Devil, I waxa your car.
Danielson, I need your urine.
Yeah.
No urine, no tournament.
Sand the floor. Danielson. So let's move on a little bit. We talked about the vaudeville, the classic female blues explosion of the 20s. What about Boogie Woogie?
Boogie Woogie.
Boogie Woogie. Another thing happening in the 20s.
That was this.
I would say you're going, well, I mean.
Jelly Roll Morton?
I don't know. Well, Jelly Roll, I'd still have to say maybe you're looking into a little bit of the ragtimes a little bit. Still.
Well, that's what it was influenced was ragtime, jazz.
Big Joe Turner as well is also included into that.
Wilbur Sweatman.
Oh, man. Good music. Great music.
Not my particular forte with the blues, but I don't
know. Fantastic, though.
It was, in its own right, absolutely. But I think it kind of started shifting because, like we said, the Delta, the typical early Delta blues was very sad. It was very melancholy, 12-bar, seventh chords, very, you know, it was just a very melancholy tale. Because that's all that was happening back then. They couldn't sing about nothing upbeat.
Yeah, they were trying to get all their depression out of them.
Right.
By a lot of things.
Talking about it, basically.
More music.
Singing about it.
It was more music. You didn't really get a lot of singing. It was more swing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah. But then it started picking up, and I think they wanted to, like, because that's when they started gaining a little bit of recognition, because it all happened kind of fast. Like, within, I say fast, but I mean fast for, like, back then. I'm saying within a decade.
Right.
It started moving, like, pretty good. And they wanted something a little bit more upbeat, especially when it started moving to Chicago and stuff. Because you're not a single guy sitting in a wooden stool with a six-string guitar and a cut-off glass bottle is not going to entertain an audience of 750 people.
Even when it went to Chicago, you still had Willie Dixon playing that straight-up bass, Muddy Waters playing a guitar, and then you had your drummer.
A lot
of drummers. See, that's the unsung hero there, too, a lot is the drummers. Not a lot of people talk about them at all.
Yeah, and that started picking up pace, you know, in the jump blues in the 40s and stuff like that. But they like you were saying, it needed something a little bit more.
Absolutely.
You know, Son House sitting there with his six string or his 12 string sitting there playing in front of 750 people. Yeah. You know, there's only so much. They need a backing band. They started picking up momentum.
Exactly. And we're still forgetting about things like, you know, people like Charlie Patton.
Charlie Patton was
restarted before Robert Johnson as well. And
you're
talking about one person with a guitar and like
a because the one person with a guitar, they could play the 12 bar, that's all they can do, and sing.
Right.
You have to have that rhythm guitar player playing the 12 bar, and then you have to have somebody next to you playing the solo over the 12 bar blues.
You know
what I'm saying? So because blues, a lot of the appease to your ear is listening to the solo work done by the guitar.
Right.
So you can't get that solo without having that. You know, that the rhythm guitar going with you know, drums and the bass is, you know, I mean, it's just
right.
It's all natural. It all comes together that naturally.
Yeah. And I guess we could call that progression of the single 12-bar blue progression of the single six-string or 12-string player and singing, we could call that more into like an urban blues kind of thing when it moved to Chicago, right?
Absolutely.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They started needing to play to bigger audiences because, like, us Americans as a society, we moved past the gospel stuff. You know, you still had your Bible Belt gospel music, whatever. That's fine. And then you had also country musicians, but there was a line between that, and that's something interesting we talked about pre-show, is the line between country music and blues is as definitive as Caucasian or African American.
Absolutely.
African American with a six-string guitar, blues. Caucasian with a six-string guitar. Country music.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
I think back then they called it country western.
Country western, whatever, bluegrass.
Bluegrass.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Or other gormandizers. Country bluegrass blues or other gormandizers. But so, yeah, and that's some interesting shit. you know, when it started moving into Chicago, because then they started getting the big backing bands, they started getting the double bass, the drum, the stand up.
Started becoming rhythm and blues.
That's right.
R&B.
And that's cool.
Absolutely.
To me, that's fucking cool.
That's how it should go. That's music progressing, just like what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And so.
So fast forward to
the 40s.
Laser Lloyd. Oh, no.
In a Laser Lloyd. I don't want to listen to anybody that's first name is Laser.
There it is.
We're going to talk about Laser a little later in the show.
Laser, Blazer, and Phaser.
One of the coolest modern blues musicians these days.
That's his bass player and his drummer. Phaser and Blazer. What are you looking at, old?
I'm just looking, man. Would you relax over there?
I'm super relaxed.
Mickey Mouse. About you? Headphone wearing.
I just got me another beer. I'm good.
Yeah, we're all good. I kind of got to pee a little.
Hey, do your thing.
I might. So in the 30s, we're moving to a little bit of the electric Texas blues. That's when the electric guitar started getting introduced a little bit. I don't think they didn't have single or solid body guitars then, so they're still playing the heavily kind of distorted, crackly,
the
feedbacky hollow bodies.
Yeah.
The Gibsons and things, the Sears models.
The logs.
And I think a good example with that would be like Little Son Jackson and Lightnin' Hopkins. He played a mean six-string electric. And maybe Blind Willie Johnson,
that's a good one right there.
Yeah.
See, I forget about all these guys. It's
easy to do, man. There's so many of them, and they're all good.
That's your list right there.
I know, but
they're all good.
Getting into the songs. See, this is where we start transitioning into the really good songs and where they start sticking and everybody wants to start covering
Go ahead and transition us into that stuff.
No, we're working on it.
We're working up.
Oh.
See, he always gets so excited.
I'm getting excited.
He gets so excited.
Are we going to talk about Clapton soon?
He's like any guitar player. When we learn a freaking song, we want to play it as fast as we possibly can, and we have to get reminded to slow the fuck down.
You got to.
We want to hurry up and get through it to get to the next thing.
When does B.B. King get born?
I don't know. Sometime in the 20s or 30s.
You haven't got the Chuck Berry yet.
Chuck Berry. Ooh, you like that fart in your mouth?
You heard?
Johnny wasn't very good, you know, but and then we'll move from the electric Texas blues. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about, we're talking about how it moved into the urban style, into the bigger cities. It's starting to move to the West Coast. It's up in Chicago now. It's in New York. It's in San Francisco. It's getting a broader spectrum. And I think that kind of gave birth to the jump blues in the 40s. That was the up-tempo music. That was more brass instruments. That was a higher progression. That was a little bit quicker and a little bit more upbeat songs.
Well, it also came with a little bit more showmanship as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people were starting to play the guitar behind their back, starting to do all kinds of shit.
Yeah.
It started becoming a little bit cooler.
Yeah, Coleman Hopkins, Lionel Hampton.
Mm-hmm. People were starting to do a little bit of that shit with it.
A little bit of that chit. They were starting to get.
Don't feel bad if you don't know who the fuck half these people are, because I don't.
Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman's a new example. You need to look them up. They're good fucking folks, man.
Yeah.
You need to look them up.
Let me look them up right after this.
Yeah. And then we're going to. Okay. So we'll move from that. And we'll talk a little bit about the Chicago City and urban blues, which kind of continued on up until now. Like, they're still doing that kind of shit out there. But this is when it exploded, and that's when we're talking about Muddy Waters, Big Bill Brunzi, shit like that. And Muddy Waters, like we talked about, I don't think there is a more covered or revered blues artist.
There's not.
I really don't think so.
Starting to say we're missing a guy.
I mean, Murky this. Oceans was pretty covered.
See, like, Murky you're talking Oceans. About J.D. Lenore. I mean... Jimmy Reed is another guy. We're missing somebody here. That sucks.
We're gonna. There's so many
to talk about.
There's so many. You know, Blind Lemon Jefferson.
That's older. That's old school.
I know, man. That's old school, but that's crazy influential. Maybe you're looking Charlie Patton, Lonnie Johnson, Tampa Red, Blind Blake, Sylvester Weaver.
See, so.
Scumbag Scotty.
I like this guy.
Scumbag Scotty. Scumbag Scotty. No, I think I gave him $5 last week. I think he's hanging out under the overpass.
And he asked me for another $5 today.
Yeah. He gave me the same story. So get this. It's funny you should say that. I called out this guy the other day. He rode by me with like a fake leg. And he's like, probably 60 years old, and he's telling me that he lost his leg in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Christ. And I'm like, okay, so you were about 40 when you enlisted, or what? Like,
what if he was like a general?
He wasn't a general. He definitely wasn't a general. I can promise you that.
Take his word for it.
No, I did the first time, but the second time I just wasn't. I wasn't fucking about it. So anyway, let's talk about Muddy Waters a little bit, since that was one of my favorites. That's one of your favorites. Absolutely. That's a staple in the blues community. What do we love about Muddy Waters?
His name.
Oh, yeah, dude. I like you, man.
Yeah. Given to him by his, what was it, his grandma? Della.
Della.
Yeah, Della.
Absolutely.
He used to go out there and play in puddles and get ringworm and shit, and they called him Muddy Waters.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
His real name is McKinley Morganfield. Yeah.
This is our new show. Is this true?
Yeah, is that actually true?
It's Facebook proven right there, buddy.
Yeah, see, all you guys can just sit there behind the computer and just look up my information. Half right? It's probably wrong.
Get it from Laser Lloyd right here.
Yeah, get it from Laser Floyd.
Hey, Laser Lloyd's a good guy.
Yeah, is he? You know him?
I do.
Yeah?
He called me there, you know, that one
Is
time.
His real name Laser Lloyd?
That's what I thought.
Does he hang out with Riff Raff and the rest of those fucking fake named assholes?
I'm not responding anymore. But his name is Lloyd Paul Blumen. Blues?
Man. Blumen?
Blumen. But he's...
Or he Blumen. Naturally,
right?
Anyway, McKinley Morganfield.
He's also an acidic Jew.
McKinley Morganfield.
Yeah, McKinley Morganfield, a.k.a. Muddy Waters.
Yep.
Grew up in Mississippi, Clarksdale.
Yep.
Started playing the guitar and harmonica at age 17. And emulating local blues heroes, Sunhouse and Robert Johnson.
Sunhouse, once again, name shows up.
Yep, and the name we were looking for earlier was Alan Lomax.
Alan Lomax.
Alan
that's
Lomax.
It.
That's it. And that's who the first person to record Muddy Waters in 1941 for the Library of Congress.
That's awesome. We could not fucking remember
I could
that.
Not remember. I knew it was Alex, but I couldn't remember his last name.
That's it. Those motherfuckers would travel around the blues community and record these guys with glass records. It's fucking awesome.
Wow. It's so cool.
It is. That's coming from the president of that time. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, because he recognized good shit. He got sick of hearing Absolutely. That gospel crap, too.
Fucking
so ass. Where do you think those records are now? In the Library of Congress?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That's Absolutely. Cool.
Wouldn't that be neat to just see that?
What if you just went there and you wanted to go play them?
Are you going to be Nicolas Cage? I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to go in there and steal Sunhouse's first record.
I didn't say steal. I said listen.
I'll be a part of that.
I said listen to it. They gave you some white gloves and a Victrola and put that bitch
they
on.
They probably won't let you 10 feet near it.
Okay, well then can somebody play it for me? Can I get some government official motherfucker to play that shit for us?
I don't even know.
I'm ready for the word go. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm ready for the plan. I'm going to steal the Declaration
I'm gonna
of Independence.
I'm going to call them first.
I want the records.
Yeah, I want the records. I want Sunhouse's first recording.
Yes, please.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah, I'll take one, please.
I'll take them all.
Yeah. So in 1943, realized he wanted to be a blues man. So he moved to Chicago to become a blues man. And didn't record his first record until 1946. After he recorded with the Library of Congress. His first record outside that little stint of them traveling to the blues musicians. And that's pretty neat, too, because, like I said, in the 40s, for an African-American musician to get that sort of recognition was huge.
Well, I think that's also what Chicago was there for. You know,
yeah.
I think Chicago was giving people like that opportunity, even though it was bullshit for them and they went through a bunch of shit. But it still gave people like them an opportunity with much more of a crowd, much more people to do what they wanted to do. And people were listening to it.
Yeah.
Then you had Howlin' Wolf come along. And then Buddy Guy came along and played with them. And then much more people, even white people, but Paul Butterfield band.
Yep.
And then even with that, trying to get a little ahead of myself, but much more blues musician came from that as well.
And it was just as much of a struggle for them in the music industry. And that's something that I have the absolute utmost admiration for.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Somebody that has that much passion, that has gone through that much strife and kept moving towards one particular goal. That's amazing.
The Muddy Waters, right?
Muddy Waters. That's Howlin' Wolf, all of them.
It's eventually what gave to his demise as well, was that power and thinking that he was God walking on water.
You're right.
Same thing.
He did?
Yeah. And yeah, Kanye West is his son. You didn't know?
What a
I'm just kidding. He's not.
What an idiot.
He got a little bit of a God complex, you know.
He did.
But he didn't start getting a whole lot of recognition in record play and making any money until later on in his life, when they would actually allow him to have a backing band.
Yes.
Because in the very beginning, these blues musicians that were moving anywhere, you know, Chicago predominantly, from the Mississippi Delta and from the southern, you know, Louisiana jug band Delta stuff, they weren't allowed to have backing bands.
Just a three-piece band.
Just a three-piece band, and they had to make it happen. And when he moved to Chicago, Muddy Waters, he kind of started getting his start when Big Bill Brunzi was letting him open for him. You know, and Muddy Waters hadn't played in front of audiences like this before. He was a juke joint player. You know, he played on street corners and all this kind of stuff. And same with Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson never got big.
Never.
He never got big. He always played
juke
joints.
Well, he was on the verge, and then he died.
Yeah. Well, they were looking for him.
Yeah.
The year he died.
To go to New York.
Yeah, they were looking for him to go to New York and record.
Yep.
And they couldn't find him because he was dead.
Yeah.
He got killed by poison.
That's what fucking happens to you when you sell your soul to the fucking devil.
Yeah, that's what happens when you sell your soul to the fucking devil. Kids, don't sell your soul to the fucking devil.
Don't do it. It's bad.
Don't do drugs. Don't eat Starburst with razor blades in them. And don't meet the devil at the crossroads, because then you're going to have the hellhounds on your heels.
You don't want that.
You don't want that. I've had that. You don't want that. No, I haven't had that.
So nothing came out of Florida.
No, except for big ass snakes. And eventually Leonard Skinner.
Yeah, right.
And maybe Greg Allman.
And maybe Molly Hatchet.
And Molly Hatchet. Nobody fucking cares about Molly Hatchet. Let's be real. And Red Jumpsuit Apparatus, which literally nobody cares about.
Yellow Card.
Ever.
Oh, I mean, don't forget Shinedown.
Yeah, Shinedown. Great.
Limp Bizkit.
Oh, yeah. Fred Durst. You know, Red Jumpsuit Apparatus is actually playing literally right around the corner here. I think they're actually playing for tips or something.
Tonight?
No, tomorrow.
Okay, fair enough.
Better tomorrow. Enough. They couldn't pay me to go watch that. Like, if they're like, bro, we'll give you $40 to come watch us play, I'd be like, I don't. I mean, nah.
I hear one song.
I'm good.
Face down?
Yep. One song.
That's it.
That's it.
That's all they got. So, didn't Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters actually have a rivalry?
Absolutely.
In they Chicago
together,
for a while?
Then they started getting their own stuff together.
Yeah.
They started hating each other after a while. One got big head, the other one got a big head, and they thought they were better than each other.
Yeah.
Howlin' Wolf had a distinctive voice. It was the beauty about him. He had the distinctive voice.
Wolf?
Absolutely.
Oh, my God, dude.
It was kind of like a raspy
yell.
It takes something to listen to. People listen to it, you're like, what am I listening
to? You got what I need?
Yeah.
It sounded like Mr. T.
Raspy.
Yeah.
It was an odd thing to listen to back in those days, but it's just what it is. It was a hard listen, but he was a good musician. He's
absolutely
really a huge guy. Can go down the neck of that guitar, just play it. Just it was great to watch. It was fun.
Yeah, and I think what caused a lot of that rift between them is because we mentioned Willie Dixon writing a lot for Muddy Waters. He actually wrote a lot for Howlin' Wolf too.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what caused a lot of the rift between those cats.
It was too, because Willie Dixon is the composer.
Yeah. And which is interesting because his music's fantastic. You wouldn't picture him as like a behind the scenes songwriter.
So thus, then you get that's where it started at, basically. Then you have feuds going on, and music keeps going from there.
I love it. It was like the first rap battle.
Yeah, basically. Sure.
I love it.
When are we going to talk about Joe Bonamassa
later? See, always wanting to skip ahead, this motherfucker. Always. He's the fastest.
We're just starting with the Chicago blues, man.
Yeah, dude, we're not even through there yet.
The only thing I know about the Chicago blues is that when I play my backing tracks, some of them are called Chicago blues. Well, and then I play over it.
That's enough.
Paul Butterfield Band, man. That's where Steve Miller got to start from them.
Yeah. Go on.
White guy having fun with the black community, doing black music, basically.
Nice.
I mean, that's how it goes. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's great. And it started showing some semblance of togetherness.
Absolutely.
And because I've always had this theory that there is only a couple things left in this world today that actually bring people together on an even plane, and music is one of them.
The fucking key. Music is the fucking key to happiness.
Right, because other than physical touch, I don't think there's anything that can affect your emotions more radically than music.
Absolutely.
And that brings people together because we may be like of different gender, of different color or whatever, but we all have one love for music.
Especially blues.
Especially blues. And I feel like, I don't know, man, I feel like the blues needs to make more of a comeback. It is. It's starting to because a lot of like, because if you turn on a rock station nowadays, you'll hear this bullshit. There's not even a real band anymore. It's all software. It's all auto-tune. It's all the riffs.
Samples.
It's all samples.
Well, yeah, if you listen to pop music, I mean, there's still rock and roll. It's not dead. It's still out there.
No, it's still out there. But like I said, I think a lot of the good musicians today are reverting back to the blues.
Well,
a lot of the budding rock stars today.
Yeah, okay.
Are reverting back to the blues, I think.
I could see that.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, you have to because you can't have the rock and roll without the blues.
That's right. And it's funny, man, because times are going back. People like vinyl's coming back. Band t-shirts are coming back. People are starting to talk about Zeppelin more again and the blues.
Who's the band that sounds like Zeppelin? That's out now, man.
Greta Van Fleet.
Oh, Greta Van Suckage.
Greta Van Fleet. I love, like, I watch an interview with them and the interviewer asks, he goes, so was one of your main influence Led Zeppelin? They're like, no, we don't know what you're talking about. You're a fucking liar, dude.
We don't want to be sued.
Yeah, you're a fucking liar, you Robert Plant sounding motherfucker. Don't you lie to me. You sat there and listened to Led Zeppelin 1-4 and Physical Graffiti on repeat for 6 years, and then you were like, what?
He even plays a fucking SG.
Yeah.
Sounds like all of us, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. So I guess since we talked about the rival between Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, we can talk about Howlin' Wolf a little bit.
All right.
Chester Arthur Burnett.
That's right.
Wow, you knew that right off the top of your head. That's absolutely fucking awesome. And one of, like he said, or like you said, his main attraction was his booming voice.
Absolutely. He was a big dude.
Yeah. Most of those guys back then, the blues musicians, were doing that yodel, that vibrato blues sound that was coming out of the 20s and 30s.
Wolfman Jack.
No, Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, he was scaring motherfuckers into liking him. Like, he would grab you, like, for real.
He's a big dude.
Yeah, scary.
I wouldn't want to fuck with him.
Scary.
That's all right. I'm like 5'10". He fucking kill me.
Yeah, and he learned to
smash
play.
Muddy Waters into the Muddy Waters.
Yeah. That's why I'm saying, that's probably why, like, Muddy Waters, if I was Muddy Waters, I'd be like, yeah, bro, I hate you.
No, but
run away.
But I respect you, though, bro. I promise. You got a great suit on. Your music's nice. I hate you, though, bro.
No.
I'd be real quiet and respectful about it. Because Howlin' Wolf would have fucking beat his ass.
I'd be the definition of two-faced.
Yeah. I feel like Howlin' Wolf's blood pressure was like 178. Over 94 at all times.
That's how I would be.
Yeah. That guy. Like resting, sleeping. That's his blood pressure. That guy had straight mayonnaise going through his veins at all times. He was a beast.
Howlin' at the Moon was a great album, if I do believe so correctly. I can't remember right now.
Yeah.
But great albums. That dude was amazing.
Yeah. And nobody he learned to play from Charlie Patton.
Not one person to this day sounds like that guy.
Nobody.
Not one person.
Nobody. And he, like I said, he learned how to play from Charlie Patton. We talked about him a little bit. And, you know, he got his break in Chicago in the early 50s, late 40s.
Now we're talking.
With Ike Turner of Sun Records.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, that's when he started breaking his shell out.
That's when Chess Records was starting to get real big out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Where they were starting to sign everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great record label. If nobody's ever heard of it, look at that. I would devil into it a lot. Was looking at record labels for blues, and that is one of them. Chess Records is amazing.
Yeah. Isn't it so funny how, like, these different genres throughout time, when something breaks out and it becomes that new wave sound that nobody's heard about again, it's like a stock market opening, like a weird new stock. All these record companies just go out and start buying up every piece of it.
That's exactly what was happening.
Yeah, it happened with the, you know, the quote-unquote grunge era, the British music invasion, the British blues rock invasion. It happened with the blues, everything.
Here we go. We can start talking about that.
Yeah, now we can start talking about that. Yeah, and I
so
love...
So in walks Eric Clapton.
Yeah, in walks a man. Well, I got one more cat that actually, this guy got me into blues. This was one of the... Well, I have two to talk about. That I like one more than the other. So Lead Belly.
Nirvana right there.
Yeah, that's a Lead Belly favorite amongst them. But the one that really, when I first got introduced to blues, I always knew what the blues was. But when I first got really introduced to it, it was one by a former supervisor of mine named Candace Carter. She introduced me to R.L. Burnside. R.L. Burnside is probably my favorite pre-50s blues musician of all time. He's fantastic. He learned a lot of his stuff from Mississippi Fred McDowell, which taught a lot of those guys back then. And I don't know, to me, he just sounds different. He almost mumbles. He's only got six teeth.
He does.
Well, he did. He died in 05, but he had the same start as all those guys in the Mississippi Delta. They were playing juke joints. You know, they were jamming around. He didn't get big until the 80s.
Have you ever heard of a man called Jimmy Reed?
Uh-uh.
Jimmy Reed is from basically like the Indiana set up there in the region, is what they call East Chicago.
Yeah.
Same kind of way. Raspy voice, really good.
Yeah.
You might want to check him out when you get a chance.
Absolutely.
He was so drunk most of the times. His wife was sitting there giving him the lyrics in the studio while he's singing the songs.
And really?
You can even listen to it, and you can tell that the guy is just fucking wasted singing these fucking songs.
I love it.
It's fantastic.
I love it, dude.
But R.L. Burnside, absolutely, man.
Fantastic. I got one of his records in there. I forget which one it is, but it was one that he did. It was a remix record of some of his early stuff that he did with his nephew, Cedric Burnside. And it's fantastic. It's amazing.
I'd love to give it a listen.
You should. I'll let you borrow it, man.
I got some Jimmy Reed for you to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's do it.
You'll really like it. What about you, Audio Slave? What's your favorite blues musician? I know what the fuck you're going to say already. No. I know what you're going to say already. David Gilmour.
No.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say anything.
His shit's all blues.
I don't like anybody in particular. I like them all the same. How's that?
You like them all the same.
Yes. Every one of them is great in my eyes.
Fuck off. Say something, dude.
Yeah.
Joe Bonamassa.
Okay, oh, also, little plug about the blues. They invented slide guitar, so you're welcome.
Ooh.
If you guys don't know what slide guitar is, that's go watch Black Snake Moan and watch fucking Samuel L. Jackson murder it.
There's actually a song out there called Black Snake Moan.
Is there?
Yeah.
There's a movie called Black Snake.
Absolutely, yeah. There is.
Well, you know, we should probably just go ahead and call this episode the early blues, and we'll have to do a modern blues.
The sky is crying.
No, we still got some time, man.
There's not enough time for what we got
to
talk about.
There's so much time. Let's jump forward. Let's jump forward to the 50s blues explosion.
Chuck Berry.
Let's talk about Chuck Berry. Okay. Johnny B. Goode.
Who wants to start with that?
Everybody
saw Back to the Future.
Yeah. Everybody's seen Chuck Berry. Everybody's heard Johnny B. Goode.
Everybody knows who Halle Berry is.
Yeah. But has anybody seen Chuck Berry fart in a hooker's mouth?
No.
we're actually going here.
This is a kids show.
It's not a kids show. So when you guys get a chance, go ahead and go to Google and look up Chuck Berry farts in hooker's mouth. And it's the funniest thing that I've ever seen because it's such a revered musician of mine.
You are disgusting.
No, he's disgusting.
I'm dying laughing is what I'm doing.
Yeah, he's a funny dude, man. He had a little bit of a dark side to him, a little dark side to the Berry. But what do you got going on over there, Drew?
I'm trying to find the reference in here. I actually pointed it out with Black Snake Moan for that Elmore James. It's interesting. Great book. If you have ever seen it, Martin Scorsese presents the blues.
That's a weird one. Martin Scorsese?
Oh, yeah. He does films for Rolling Stones. I mean, absolutely.
Really? I thought he just did like big commercial movies and things.
No, he's actually got seven movies for this called, you know, with the blues, separate genres for each aspect of blues. It's great.
Hell yeah. So Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry, the godfather of rock and roll.
The godfather of rock and roll. I did a couple excerpts of him on the Facebook page. He was a pretty influential dude.
Absolutely.
I would say.
He started it all, in my opinion.
Yeah. Did he continue with that 12-bar blues progression in his plan?
He did, actually.
But he took it to the next level,
didn't
he?
Took it to the next level.
That Electric Avenue shit.
Once again, that the... You thinking you're the shit?
Yeah,
your shit don't stink. Obviously.
Yeah, his shit doesn't stink. He's farting in hookers' mouths, dude.
Hookers' mouths.
Oh, you like that fart? You like that? You like that fart?
Okay. Black Snake Moan.
He was a pioneer.
He's a pioneer
in more than one way.
Yeah, and so that gave birth to the British blues rock? Because obviously there's always been this back and forth between America and Britain in the music community. Blues started in America. The British musicians started hearing a little bit of electric guitar in the blues, and they wanted to continue it and pay it forward a little bit.
Here we go.
Right? Absolutely. So what springs out of there?
Rolling Stones, actually, in my opinion, started it. They were the ones that first listened to it. They were in a boarding school, basically, Catholic boarding school, and they would sneak out, get records, and play them. And that's exactly what they did. They would go get these blues records, and they loved them. Over there, they loved the blues scene. It was exploding.
Oh, bad. That's what they were buying.
Absolutely.
And Brian Jones, that was a lot of his influence with the Rolling Stones. That was even from the name. They got their name from a Muddy Water song, absolutely. Rolling Stone.
Yep.
Thus the snowball effect happens here.
Yeah, the record, the A&R man called up Brian Jones and Mick and was saying, hey, man, well, we want to have you over for a set. What do we call you? And they happened to look down at a Muddy Waters album on the floor and said, oh, Rolling Stones.
Fantastic.
And that was the birth of it.
Here we go.
These guys. And Cream.
Yardbirds.
Yardbirds. Yep. All of them, man.
Yardbirds, Cream. Here we go. Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton. Zeppelin.
Page.
Yeah. Page. He was a huge studio musician.
That's what happens. That's what happens when
body starts slapping.
I hate to say it, dude. That's what happens when hate takes control over music in the country that we live in, and people across the pond notice what really good music is all about, and they take full advantage of it.
And they pick out the good shit, leave the bad shit, and then explode.
Boom.
And then there it goes.
Gotta love it.
Yeah, gotta love it. And Fleetwood Mac, too. We talked a little bit about that. Early Fleetwood Mac.
Early Fleetwood Mac. Peter Green. That's my favorite. I have to say it.
That's pre-Stevie days, right?
Absolutely. Stevie Ray Vaughan is hands down my favorite.
Yeah. Stevie Ray Vaughan, man. What a weird way to die, too.
He has such big fingers, man. You play on those 12s, you know, the 12-gauge strings.
Yeah.
It's hard to play on those things. It's like almost like playing a bass guitar.
Yeah.
Those strings are so thick.
I think I play on 10s. I think I play 10s on my electric. 11s on the acoustic.
I don't play shit. I'm just listening to music.
Well, so you had those hugely influential bands. We've talked a lot about Eric Clapton in the past. Obviously, he, in my opinion, was probably one of the best things to come out of there, obviously. He's huge. He took it to another level.
I'd say Jimmy Page, in my opinion.
Jimmy Page, too.
As far as the blues go, Eric Clapton, hands down, is the better blues player.
Well, I don't know. It all depends, though, because they both took their music derived from the blues and took it in their own individual directions. Jimmy Page just cranked up the distortion a little bit heavier.
No.
That's where heavy metal comes from.
Right. Yep. Agreed. You know.
I mean,
Deep Purple.
That's where the blues.
Makes him the fucking better guitar player.
The Blues Breaker album by Eric Clapton is where Fender got the name for their Blues Breaker amplifier.
Yeah.
So I mean, right there.
Touché.
And the new Eric Clapton is one of my personal favorite modern day blues musicians. Modern day musicians, period. Joe Bonamassa.
Yeah.
Joe Bonamassa, like we talked about a little bit earlier, is probably one of the top five best musicians walking this earth right now.
Oh, dude! When he was 12 years old, he opened up a whole year, 1990, I think, for B.B. King.
Yeah.
At 12 years old.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
12.
That dude can play.
Yeah.
He also has what's called the Bonham Museum. He's got pretty much one of the biggest.
800 guitars and shit?
Over 1,000 guitars.
There we go. That was close.
Awesome. Really? Awesome guitars. Yeah. And he's got what's called burst guitars by Gibson. They're one of the most expensive type of guitars you can buy. He's got like 10 of those.
And he can play it damn good.
He's got
too.
A collection of Tweed and Fender amps.
He's got an amp named after him now.
Well, yeah. But
Fender Blues
he's
Jr.
also got a collection of amps that he's been collecting since he was like 10 years old. You know, so I mean, he's got a freaking. He calls it the Bonham Museum because he's got enough shit to open up an actual museum.
See, this is why I like not playing music. I like listening to it because people like him. You guys can play it, and I love listening to it.
Yeah.
That's what I enjoy doing.
It's great, man.
I'm not one of those guys that likes to play it, you know?
Well, you don't need to love music. You don't need to be a musician to love good music.
Yeah. Listening to people like you guys talking about guitars like that, it's just awesome, you know?
It is. It's amazing, man. And obviously, you can see with Joe Bonamassa, he took what Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck did turned the volume to 11, dude. And he took all of these influences, all the Muddy Waters, the Howlin' Wolf, the Blind Lemon, all these guys, and just turned it into something amazing.
See, now you're talking about these guys. So there's other people I want to name out, like Lonnie Mack.
Lonnie Mack.
Like John, you know, Jeff Beck, even Steve Ray Vaughan. They were, that was like their idol was, dude, absolutely.
Steve Winwood,
yep.
Absolutely.
Yep, Warren Haynes.
Warren Haynes,
dude.
I love this shit. We can do this.
Derek Trucks.
Yep.
Yeah. Blondie Chaplin.
I like you.
Dude, it's all good stuff. This is all amazing stuff.
I love it. Oh, there it is.
Oh, yeah. Look, he's got it.
Yeah.
He's got it right there. So Joe Bonamassa, like I said, he's also a really good backing musician, too, because I hear him on a lot of other people's tracks.
Well, yeah, he's played with Foreigner, for God's sakes. I mean.
God, can't live without Foreigner. Good Lord.
But he's also played with his love, you know, his rock gods, his blues gods, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
He's played with, you know, Eric Clapton, and he's played with Buddy Guy. He's played with Warren Haynes, Derek Trucks. All those guys played with him.
Yep.
Which is awesome, man. Could you imagine that? I couldn't even fathom being able to play with my heroes.
Like, no. I could because I'm not playing. I just stand there.
Yeah, just stand there and watch them.
What if you were a singer? What if you're a blues singer?
Not going to sing good.
Have you ever tried?
I'm just going to stand there.
Have you ever tried to sing?
Nope.
One of these days, you're going to come over and you're going to try to sing the blues in my house.
Nope.
Yes.
Some Howlin' Wolf.
You have a.
That maybe I could do.
You might have. Your voice might be like raspy and good.
I'm not going to try right now. It's not happening.
I didn't say you were.
Okay, cool.
I'm saying at my house, we can play one day.
At my house. At son's house.
Joe Bonamassa, I have to say this real quick. There's a podcast that's on YouTube. I think it's Nikki Six. What's my favorite riff? Have you seen that yet?
Not that one, no.
Well, after we're getting done with this, I hope you get a chance to watch it with Joe Bonamassa with Nikki Six. My favorite riff. It's awesome. He gives a clinic on it. It is. All of them. Johnny Five's on there. And they talk
really?
About it. Absolutely.
What podcast is this? Nikki Six's?
Nikki Six is.
Absolutely.
It's favorite. Like a guitar lesson type deal.
It's, really?
It's fucking ridiculous.
Bonamassa, if you go on his Facebook page.
And Tom Morello from Rage Against Machines on there.
If you go on to Bonamassa's King of the Wall. YouTube page. Yes. He's got tons of lessons.
Well, see, I was just going to say that because I'm not friends with him on Facebook, but I'm friends with him on Instagram. And that's one of the reasons why I love being friends with him on Instagram.
Following?
Are you not friends with somebody on Instagram? You just follow somebody?
I don't have an Instagram.
Well, I'll never call myself a follower, Mark. I'm more of a leader.
Well, if you follow Joe Bonamassa, you're following him.
I'm friends with Joe Bonamassa.
You're not your follower.
But because I love to hear his lessons, and he'll sit there and like break down riffs of his, and even his broken down versions, I'm like sitting here wiping my glasses. I'm like, God damn it. Why is he so good? Why are you so good?
He's a virtuoso, man.
Dude.
Hours and hours and hours and hours of practice.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if that was my job.
Absolutely.
I'd probably be pretty good.
Right? His dad was a guitar player.
Yeah.
Showed him a little bit of stuff. And then, like, by age 10, he was, like, way better than his dad. He's been playing for 20 years.
Yeah, but, like, age 12, going an opening for B.B. King.
That's like Stevie with his brother. He's just better at it, you know?
He's a virtuoso, man.
It's crazy. Some like people got it.
Some child prodigy.
Just like Albert King with B.B. King, in my opinion. I think Albert King's way better than B.B. Yeah. King.
I mean, look at Doogie Howser.
For God's sakes.
What the fuck are we talking?
Anyway, you guys got any other subjects you want to touch on with the blues?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
You're from this area, in my opinion, Jacksonville. J.J. Gray.
J.J. Gray.
Is what is up. They are amazing. I hope you all listen to them. I think they have like 4 or 5, maybe 6 albums.
So they're local here in Jacksonville.
Absolutely
then.
Local here in Jacksonville.
But they sell out every time they play.
Really?
Fantastic band.
Where do they play at usually?
They usually play with Mofro a lot.
Well, it is J.J. Gray and Mofro, but they play at the amphitheater in St. Augustine. They play at the theater downtown.
So they're playing bigger venues. They're not playing like, you know, the Rabbit or whatever.
They used to.
Yeah, but they're...
What was that fucking place called that was right there on the corner next to the Buckets down at the beach?
Freebirds,
right? Yeah. They used to play there. I don't know if they play there any fucking more.
No, Freebirds is gone.
They're too big to play there now.
Well, I mean, what is it? The Surfer of the fucking Bar?
The Surfer of the Bar, yeah.
Supposedly they're trying to get shows back in there.
I'm sure they play
at
Ponte Vedra Concert Hall.
Well, they had Bad Fish there not too long ago.
They're not bad. They're a nice Sublime cover band. I like them.
I've seen them a few times.
I saw them at Freebird years ago.
I like that, man. J.J. Gray and Mofro, if anybody's ever...
J.J. Gray and Mofro. Are they on Apple Music?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Groovy. I'm going to check them out.
Do it.
Awesome. Well, we're going to wrap this one up. I don't know when I think we're going to record one either next week or the week after. As always, if you guys have any show ideas, please email me at willywhitebread69@gmail.com.
Can we do another blue show?
Yeah, we can do another blue show.
Blues part two. We barely tapped into modern blues.
Oh, barely. Barely tapped into it.
I would love to do it.
Absolutely. We can, that'll be the next topic then.
Let's do it.
We've got our next topic, guys.
Please.
So give us a watch on Facebook at The Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping Podcast Facebook page. Share our stuff. We're going to be doing more t-shirt giveaways. We're going to be doing more rock history posts. We're going to be doing all the things that you love and you're going to love. So just fucking pay attention, man.
Fuck yeah.
Anyway, till next week, we love you. We will see you again very soon.
Bye.